Hello and welcome to episode 5 of Space Talks, a science-based show with a particular interest in all things space. This is Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods on Vancouver Island. And hi, Tim, how are you doing today?
Very well, thanks, Steve. And I have to say, we have a few updates. It seems like no sooner do we put some topic on the air than we find ourselves realizing that there's more to add, events that are overtaking us on a nearly daily basis. For example, we mentioned balloons a little while ago and the controversy about what was happening with the balloons. Turns out there were many more of them in the air, and there's now widespread speculation that they're not aliens, but in fact, harmless balloons. Also, there is news about a meteor that flew through the skies over Texas, creating a considerable bit of alarm with its luminosity. And then we also talked some time ago about the problems with the International Space Station and the fact that there is a leaking Soyuz spacecraft. Well, now it seems there's a second Soyuz spacecraft with a very similar problem, creating new concern over how and when resupply ships are going to make it to the ISS. So my goodness, that's a lot of updates in just a few days.
With regard to the lag times that you were alluding to, Tim, by the time that any particular episode that we've got on Space Talk airs, it just seems like 3 or 4 weeks might have passed. So it is difficult trying to keep things updated, as you say. With regard to that meteor over Texas, apparently it created quite a sonic boom as it broke through the sound barrier. And what listeners have to realize is that if you're on a spot on the ground and an airplane, for example, breaks the sound barrier, you hear that sound barrier being broken, but so do people along the path of it. So it's not just a singular point that gets hit with the sonic boom. It's totally along the path. So villagers in point A, B, and C all reporting these great thunderous shakings. And of course, if it happens in the middle of the night, that really tends to upset us.
Steve, you know, this is sort of a great segue into our topic of the day, which is in fact the first time we've had anything of a controversial topic to discuss, and that would be UFOs. I suspect more than one person in Texas heard that sonic boom and looked up in the sky and thought, my goodness, we're being invaded by aliens. Are they actual little green men in flying machines? Are they actual genuine visitors to planet Earth from distant civilizations far, far advanced than our own? Well, who's to say? And let's admit that this is a controversy that isn't just based in Texas or Canada, but it's one that's continued basically around the world.
I tend to be a skeptic about these things, Tim, but before we go too much further, I think we should differentiate between someone who's a skeptic and someone who's a cynic, and the two are not synonymous. By definition, skeptics tend to be positive and open-minded and can change their minds given facts, whereas cynics tend to be negative and closed-minded, and they stick with an existing dogma. Oh, incidentally, our topic today of UFOs for unidentified flying objects has recently been updated with another acronym of UAP, which stands for Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon. So six of one, half dozen of the other, I guess.
So, Steve, I think it's fair to say that when these UFOs or UAPs are considered, they present quite a number of unique challenges that are worthy of our discussion and exploration. What are these aliens looking for? Do they have a shopping list? Are we in danger? What is the danger represented by visitors from such a far advanced society to our own? And is there anything we could be doing or should be doing about it? And another one that I find particularly important is, what does it say about the distances involved and the technology involved for any spacecraft to make it to our little lonely corner of the universe? And finally, another one that I think is maybe a bit more philosophical, it would be, why us? We know that there are hundreds of millions, if not billions of planets, hundreds of millions that would be capable of sustaining life. What's so special about us? Why would they bother showing up in our neighborhood? So there's a lot to chew on right there.
Let's go with the interesting premise that UFOs, and by extension, I guess we're talking about aliens, and we're talking about intelligent aliens, not things like the Blob in that famous 1950s movie starring Steve McQueen, of all people. But so I guess they would perhaps come and visit Earth for one of three categories. As we do in the summertime, it might be sightseeing. Welcome to the planet Earth. Look at these ancient, primitive, intelligent beings, sort of as we look at silverbacks in a zoo. On another hand, they might be here for malevolent purposes. We have resources that they need. I don't know, metallic sources, ores and minerals, or perhaps they're here for our water. And thirdly, as in the 1951 movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, perhaps they're altruistic in their intent and they're here to show us the way.
Well, we have to try to sort all of this out in a short amount of time. And part of our challenge is to think of the alternative explanations to the mountain of evidence, the plethora of sightings. Surely they can't all be real. And also find time to talk about a more serious consideration of what and how this might actually happen.
The listeners may recall that in one of our previous episodes, we talked about the failabilities and the limitations of the human mind. I think we should begin today's topic in depth with a little bit of looking at that. We do have cognitive limitations. One of them is a visual one. For example, we all have blind spots in our eye. So when light enters through the lens, it gets focused onto the retina, and the retina has a blind spot where the optic nerve enters the brain. So it's a very simple little test that you can do and to see where your particular blind spot is. So what the brain does is it tends to confabulate. That means to make up things. By definition, confabulation doesn't mean lying. It means making things up or altering things, not with the intent to lie, cheat, or deceive. So, for instance, every time that we look at something, it could be a blank piece of paper or a complex geometrical shape. Your left eye has a blank dot. Your right eye has a blank dot. But your brain does not perceive a wall with a blank dot in it. What it does is kind of really, really strange. It takes an average of the colors or shapes or patterns all around that black spot, does a copy, and pastes it into that spot. So it actually adds things to what you're seeing. Another limitation that we have, the brain also does the opposite. It erases things that are there all the time. Like, for instance, right now, if your eyes are open, you don't see your nose. But your eyes always see your nose. But because your nose doesn't move, doesn't shake, doesn't do anything in a moving fashion, the brain says, oh, this is just extraneous visual information. It's overload. So we're just going to forget about it. So the brain automatically makes things up and automatically deletes things. Tim, you know what the police do when they play good cop, bad cop, don't you?
Well, there's the witnesses are separated immediately after an incident. And one of the reasons I understand they do this is because of the propensity of people to muddle up their memories and then cement those incorrect memories. It makes it hard to rule out the possibility that one witness with an accurate recall of event hears another explanation and comes to believe that that is, in fact, what they saw and heard. Obviously, with UFOs, this could clearly be an instance of a kind of group hysteria where people start sharing stories and they eventually believe that the story that some other person told them was what they saw and heard themselves and become convinced of such. And we no longer able to separate the wheat from the chaff.
Well, Tim, speaking of mass hysteria, I think it's a good thing to point out that such a thing really happened in 1954 in the state of Washington. A fella noticed that his windshield was pitted. It hadn't been there. Suddenly, this pit had occurred. And for whatever reason, he made the astronomical jump, shall we say, of saying that aliens had done this. Within a day or so of him reporting this, hundreds and hundreds of fellow citizens were reporting that their car windshields were also being pitted. Now, if you've ever, and of course everybody has driven their car, and then you turn the vehicle in such a fashion so that the light is shining right through it. And all of a sudden you'll see how dirty your windshield is, and you put on the wipers and you clean it. And most of the time our focal point, of course, is through the windshield, and we're looking beyond 30 meters or 20 meters ahead, but you don't actually focus at the windshield itself. But when people started looking at their windshields with the light in the correct way, they saw pits all through them. And they're, oh my goodness, what is it? What is this caused by? Cosmic rays, H-bomb tests, aliens. It has to be aliens. And this phenomena spread around Washington through various states into Canada as well. Apparently, some 15,000 vehicles were inspected by police because of this hysterical phenomenon of aliens doing something. There was even a newspaper ad, or a headline, I should say, saying, "Aliens, please stop pitting our windshields." And of course, that all died away. Now, why did this fellow announce it in the first place? Well, I think it's sort of like crop circles and Nessie. Some clever people saying, let's pull a hoax, and other people unintentionally get drawn into it.
Well, Steve, I think the hysteria, you said, you mentioned the example in Washington State was 1954, but I think you'd agree that it was in the late 40s and 50s when this flying saucer outbreak really took hold in the United States. And in part, it had a lot to do with the end of the hot war, WW2, when rising fear of Russia and what it was capable of started to really take hold in America. People were looking up in the sky, fearful of seeing goodness knows what in the form of rockets and bombs and such, and began to become quite paranoid. The U.S. started flying high balloon intelligence programs in that year, around that time, I understand. Project Mogul was a top secret military operation, and they had microphones lofted into the stratosphere on high altitude balloons, whose primary purpose was to detect long distance sound waves generated by Soviet atomic bomb tests.
When one of those balloons came down, and the particular one I'm thinking of, also had radar reflectors on them. So it was a device not only that had the microphones, but it had various right angles on it, and was made of a brand new material called Mylar, new at the time. And it landed on the rancher's farm, and he mentioned it to the military, and the military quickly secreted it away. And this became known as the Roswell flying saucer incident. And the Air Force absolutely did cover it up, because they figured it was easier to let the aliens take the blame than try to explain their secret program. If the newspaper and the media want to believe in flying saucers, that's just fine with the Air Force.
Do you know, Steve, in the first half of our episode today, we've started to look at the explanations, the limitations of the brain, the way we record information. It doesn't explain them all. And hopefully we can, in the second half of the episode today, go into some of the other challenges that we mentioned at the top of the show. How do we come to understand why there are so many sightings, and can any of them be real?
We should also mention Area 51, which is a very real thing. Area 51, as our listeners may be somewhat familiar with, is a top secret military installation, alternatively known as the Ranch, where the Lockheed Corporation developed the now famous U-2 spy plane. And subsequent to the U-2 spy plane, Lockheed also built the A-12, which later became the SR-71. They also built the F-117 Nighthawk, which was the world's first stealth fighter. And all of these programs would be flying during the night without lights on, except perhaps for the odd navigation light just before landing. You have strange shapes flying in the sky, producing perhaps strange sounds because of muffled or redirected engines. People are going to start to come up with aliens. And of course, once again, the Air Force is very, very happy to let people think that aliens are these flying objects, rather than letting the Soviets at that time know that they were on to advanced military technologies. Well, Tim, with regard to Area 51, Leon Theremin must take center stage here. He created a device in 1928, which he called the Theremin after himself. And it's basically an electronic device which generates a tone. And you can modulate that tone in pitch and volume without actually touching it. And that sound produced by the theremin has become the sound of a flying saucer, if you will. You can see a theremin being played on YouTube, but have a listen now and just pretend that you're in a movie theater, you're 9 years or 10 years old, and you're watching something like Earth versus the Flying Saucers.
Steve, I love the sound of that, and it takes me right back to my childhood. But let's branch out a bit now and talk about some of the math and the possibilities of alien life that would actually be in our Milky Way galaxy and conceivably come visit us. Now, back in the early 1960s, there was a fellow named Frank Drake, a professor, an astrobiologist, and an astrophysicist. In 1962, he had developed an equation of sorts that became incredibly famous. In fact, so famous as to be described as the second most famous equation in science after E equals mc squared. But he came up with an equation that used eight different metrics, such as stellar formation, the fraction of stars within a planetary system, fraction of planets orbiting in habitable zones, the odds of intelligent life developing there and obtaining the technological expertise necessary for us to spot them, and the likelihood that such civilizations don't destroy themselves as we seem to be doing right now. They're trying to figure out in this equation how many active civilizations at any moment in time might there be in our Milky Way.
It's going to be a large number. We talked before about, let's say there are 100 million such planets within our galaxy. We can't comprehend how much 100 million is. But the other interesting thing is those civilizations may have come and gone. If we extend that thought, we may come and go before a future civilization, you know, on the star system Betelgeuse or whatever, comes into existence. So there's also the the Venn diagram overlapping of time. And I think he had something called Project Ozma, did he not?
He did. And that started in 1960. And I'm going to come back to that in a second. I wanted to pick up on your observation about how long a civilization might last. I believe that the number that was pumped into that equation was 10,000 years, which was his estimate as to how long a civilization might rise, reach a certain level of capability, and then through some happenstance, their own bad behavior, shall we say, or a meteor, who knows? But at any rate, Project Ozma was an attempt to try and listen and see what interstellar radio transmissions might come our way. And of course, it was named Ozma after the queen in The Wizard of Oz, because Oz is described as being very far away, difficult to reach, and populated by strange and exotic beings.
Project Ozma later became known by its better name as SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Drake, along with people such as Carl Sagan, began monitoring for radio waves. But now they've gone past just looking for radio waves. Scientists are now designing state-of-the-art technosignature detectors to examine the chemical composition of an exoplanet's atmosphere. So, for example, if methane is detected, well, methane is an off-gas of a biological entity. And so if methane is detected, perhaps there is life form which is giving that off. Who knows? There's also a chance of looking for satellite arrays. So, for instance, our planet Earth has got all kinds of satellites orbiting around it. If someone were observing us from a distance, they would tend to notice that there would be various kinds of reflections off those satellites, indicating that perhaps there's something around the planet.
Well, what we've got now is investigation into how many potential players there might be, civilizations with the ability to reach out and look or travel, But the travel part of the equation is pretty complicated. So the math starts with how many intelligent life forms might abound in our galaxy, and that number would seem to be extremely large. But on the other hand, how many of them could travel the distance to get to the planet Earth? The closest star to our own is Proxima Centauri, a scant 4.2 light years from us. It has two known planets. Now, let's try and say, how quickly could we get one of our own spacecraft from here to there? Right now, the Parker Space Probe, launched in August of 2018, is the fastest such vehicle that we know of, and it's traveling at the incredible speed of 690,000 kilometers per hour, a lot faster than the car I drive, I can assure you. And that vehicle, the Parker Space Probe, were it sent today and pointed at Proxima Centauri, would take over 6,300 years one way. And that's to the closest star, a mere 4 light years away.
Jim, I have to laugh at that distance. One of my radio shows was on 4 years ago. So that means that particular show has now reached Alpha Centauri.
Let me be the first to congratulate you on being an interstellar radio host.
Let's say we're on this space probe that's going 690,000 kilometers per hour, and it takes 6,300 years to reach there. So obviously no one lives that long. So if you built a spaceship that could do it, they call those generation ships, where the people that get on board are screened for all kinds of physical attributes, mental abilities, skill sets, and they know that they will never live to reach their destination, but their great-great-grandchildren might. And it brings to mind a science fiction novel I once read about a spaceship undergoing such a mission. And so let's say 6,300 years from now, they arrive at their destination, open up the door, and they're greeted by fellow Earthlings who, in the intervening millennia, had advanced sufficiently in technology to beat them there.
Now, we've seen TV shows like Star Trek where spacecraft travel a lot faster than light. And there was the great movie by Jodie Foster called Contact, where they travel through wormholes. What's the proposed theory about, Steve? What is a wormhole, and is there one near us?
My understanding of a wormhole is perhaps best imagined by taking, shall we say, a piece of printer paper. And if you draw a dot at the top and draw a dot at the bottom and call them A and B, if you measure that distance, it's about 20 centimeters. So if you were to draw your finger and go from A to B, you're traveling a distance of 20 centimeters. However, if you take the paper and fold it so that A overlaps B, there's no distance between them. A is on top of B. So all that you have to do is fold the paper. Well, now we're talking about space. So if you're going from A to B in space, all you have to do is fold the space or warp it. We know that according to Einstein's theory of relativity, space can be warped by very massive objects. And as a matter of fact, that's how the sun has the planet Earth revolving around it. The sun is not in a flat plane. It creates a warp in space, and the planet Earth tends to fall into that warp, sort of like a large sheet of elastic.
So, Steve, the prospect of a wormhole existing is not in itself outrageous, preposterous, or inconceivable. What might be all of the above is the notion that a human could come up with a way to take advantage of it for space travel.
You'd have to, have enough energy and mass to be able to do such a thing, which is beyond the realm of possibility, at least as far as we know. And there are other explanations, for example, a black hole, which has got gravitational bringing everything down to a singularity. There are people that say, well, at the other end of the black hole, it opens up into another space or another universe. So that's a wormhole.
Well, Steve, I think both of us are the skeptics, not the cynics here. The evidence against spotting of a real visitation is pretty overwhelming, but it is not incontrovertible. It is conceivable with science that we don't know of or understand or can imagine arriving along with that visitor from some other civilization, it just seems incredulous for a lot of good reasons.
It does. But then again, there's something in my mind that says, just as we drive our cars through Park Safari African and keep the windows up so that the giraffes and elephants don't come inside, but we can look outside, just maybe we are a prime visitation spot for advanced life species that want to see how muddled up we can get through life.
Well, if it comes to being muddled up, our planet is the place to be.
And we hope that through our little bits of research, we've thoroughly muddled people's minds. Reminds me of someone trying to explain quantum mechanics. They said, now that my lecture is over, if you're more confused now than you were when you first came into the lecture hall, I've done my job properly.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, Steve, on Space Talks, and we hope you enjoyed it as much as we did researching it. And until next time, this is Tim Woods and Stephen Lowry, and saying so long until we see you next time on Space Talks, when we'll be talking about science fiction movies.
Science fiction movies? I can't wait. I'm going to buy my ticket right now. Bye, Tim.